I don't want to like accidentally blow my festive load early.
All right, starting off on a high point.
So yes, Happy New Year.
Oh yeah, Happy New Year, 2nd of January 2021.
Back on recording just before episodes come out, which is much better.
Yeah, and yeah, this is when I realised that subconsciously, at least, I drew a very thick line under 2020. And I'm now coming to terms with the fact that all of my actual life is continuing as before. And all the things I kind of mentally put off until the new year are now overdue. Fuck.
As we joked in the Christmas episode, because we were recording on the 16th, like, oh, what other terrible things could happen? And then it came out that England had a much more transmissible variant of the virus. But it wasn't bees. I feel bees strongly implied.
Yeah.
And so then a bunch of the country went into tier 4, which is basically lockdown. Yeah. Found out just before Christmas. That was fun. Loved that for me.
Yeah.
And then pretty much the rest of the country has now gone into lockdown around New Year's.
Yeah, I think there's like 3 counties in tier 3 or something, isn't there? I don't understand why we don't just... I suppose it's so we've got room to go backwards or...
Yeah. It sucks. So yeah, so that was fun. So I kind of, because I had that massive, oh hey, you're off work again indefinitely, the day before Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And then I had worked really hard to try and make Christmas as fun and close to normal as possible.
Yeah.
And that meant I had a very nice day, but it meant I automatically felt slightly disappointed afterwards, because of course it wasn't the Christmas I wanted, because
no, it was never going to be.
Yeah. So I very sensibly looked at New Year's with the thing of, it's not going to be what I want it to be, it won't be as fun, and 2021 won't feel like a brand spanking new year.
I just kept texting you as normal.
I did a Zoom call with some friends.
Oh, that's right, I did know that. You sent me a picture.
Yeah. I still got like stupidly dressed up and painted my nails and
you shamed me into putting on a dress indirectly. You didn't say anything shameful. I just realised I was still in my day pyjamas, which is a thing now.
yep.
And put on a nice dress, makeup. Didn't bother drying my hair and put my dressing gown back over on top. So
I love you so much.
New Year's Eve outfit fit for 2020, I think.
Yep. So so I was kind of prepared for the fact that 2021 wouldn't really feel new and shiny, especially as you said. Another lockdown means you're still working, but for me, this is now very, I have kind of nothing facing me for an indefinite amount of time.
Mm. Yeah, I had a somewhat ominous email from my boss just before we broke up for Christmas, saying something like, rest up, lots of changes in the new year, so that's great.
Oh, that's
looking forward
to
seeing what that's all about on Monday. I assume it just means I have more things to do.
Yeah.
Which is fine. It's good. The less dispensable I am, the better in these trying times.
In these unprecedented times. I will be studying.
Return to precedent.
I will be studying. I will be sewing. I'm going to spend a lot of time in my sewing room on this one.
You're just being general renaissance.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not very renaissance to study coding, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's modern renaissance being. Being instead of man. I've moved past mammal for you. You really are becoming the void.
Being. I would like to unbe. any New Year's resolutions?
I might try the yoga again.
I did it.
I've been really shit with it. Was it good? Is it easy?
Yeah, it's very easy.
Easy for me, considering I've not done yoga for about 2 months.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
I haven't done it for about a month, and I was fine with it.
Sweet. That is Adrienne's 30 days of yoga for listeners at home, which I usually get around to in about March, but this year I would like to do in January.
So for the last couple of years, I've managed to do it in January, and that was trying to manage it around working full-time. As I'm not working full-time, I have literally no excuse not to do it this year.
Which means you'll probably find more excuses not to.
Yep.
If you're anything like me. It's one of those terrible truisms, isn't it? That if you need something done, give it to a busy person.
Mm-hmm. This is why I'm like giving myself lots of tasks for lockdown.
Yeah, for sure. It'll be a good one. You'll be all right.
Yeah, no.
It's just another indefinite one, isn't it? That's the problem.
Yeah, at least the last one. I mean, the last one shouldn't have ended when it did. That's why we're in the state we're in now. But at least I knew when the end date was. And even with the first one back in March, like July was kind of set as this vague end date. But now it's like
a reassessment time, at least.
Yeah. Whereas now it's like some people are saying it could be a month, maybe 2 months.
Yeah. And plus there's this whole vaccine nonsense with the vaccine nonsense. I haven't gone anti-vax, don't worry. I just mean the government have decided to increase the delay between the two shots.
Yeah.
Which is...
I don't think we'll be back to... Because what really affects me is whether or not restaurants can be open, which is tier two.
Yeah.
Sorry, for those not in the UK. Tier system. Instead of just a fucking lockdown.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, I think most of our listeners not in the UK or in the US, so...
Yeah, have fun.
Yeah. Neither of us have room to judge each other right now.
Oh, absolutely not, no. But yeah, so I don't think that'll happen until March or April.
Yep. So. Which means a whole fucking year of this, eh?
Yeah, literally 12 months of this.
Yeah, I was thinking about doing it. Sometimes in the new year, I do a little writing, kind of summing up the last year, which I never put anywhere. It's just a catharsis thing.
Mm.
And I might sit down and do that. I don't really have time, but I just feel like probably some words are in there that want out.
I did Inktober, and I don't think I've got much less. Actually, that's not entirely true. I started writing a poem on New Year's Eve while I was making a dress and didn't finish the dress or the poem.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that poem was very specific to that New Year's Eve, and I don't think it's worth releasing 3 days later.
I think you should release it unfinished in July.
Well, it's about the fact that, because obviously a lot more properties come into the public domain every year, and this year the big one is The Great Gatsby.
Oh!
So the poem...
Oh, that is a good subject for a poem.
Yeah,
you can make that less New Year's Eve-y.
Yeah, no, I probably can. The poem is about basically everyone showing up to the wasteland.
Nice. Oh, I like that. In sequence.
Obviously.
Yeah. Oh, fuck. No, you need to write that. I want to read that.
Okay. Well, there you go. Now I've said it on the podcast. Yeah. I'm accountable.
You've got to get it done before Monday, otherwise someone else will steal it.
I am not going to get it done before. I might get it done on Monday.
Okay.
considering it's now Saturday.
Skipping right ahead to page 68 in my copy of this book, code being broken by a poet and a mad computer did make me think of you.
Oh, thank you. And whether the poets or the mad computer.
Both.
One thing I didn't actually put in the main show plan, because it was just a small moment, but the word Zoonos was used, and a year ago I wouldn't have known what a Zoonos was, but now.
No, yeah, that's a very, Bader Meinhof-y one, because it came up on the Great Big Quiz of the Year on Channel 4 as well, like 2 days before I read that chapter. I was like,
yep.
I know what that is.
Oh god, the Great Big Quiz of the Year was fucking terrible.
Did you not like it?
It was such a sausage fest. They got like a bunch of male comedians and then two female presenters who aren't comedian, and this just ties into the
but
thing.
But they were funny.
They were funny.
I thought they definitely held their own.
they did hold their own, but why not just put like a sensible amount of female comedians on it? It's not like
know.
There aren't
a lot.
I assume
Joe Brand was busy.
Yeah. But
that seems to be their fallback of woman who is over 30.
It's not like there aren't a lot of female comedians.
No, I know. I enjoyed it anyway, but I did note that.
Yeah. Plus, like, Jimmy Carr's just got such a fucking punchable face.
He does. I'm still kind of basking slightly in Bill Bailey winning Strictly Come Dancing. Even though
yeah, that brought me so much joy. I don't even watch Strictly, but it made me very happy.
Yeah, I sat down and watched all the videos of him after he won, because I was like, oh yeah, I wasn't really aware he was in it. And it's great. He's so multi-talented. What a twat.
How dare he?
Right, that is a renaissance man.
That is a renaissance man. Especially like when you look at his fucking musical ability as well. Horrible. Mm-hmm. How dare he? Do you want to make a podcast?
Yeah, let's make a podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Truth or Shall Make You Fret, a podcast in which we are usually reading and recapping every book from Terry Pratchett's Discworld series, one at a time in chronological order. I'm Joanna Hagen.
And I'm Francine Carroll.
And we are taking a break from the Discworld in January to talk about Terry Pratchett's second novel, mm-hmm. The Dark Side of the Sun.
If I edit together those five attempts, I think we should have just about an intro.
I did my best. This is the first time recording in like 2 weeks. We are not singing.
Yeah, we've all had a lot of not having to use our brains this week, let's be honest.
Look, I've barely spoken to humans, which I like, actually.
Have you, like, spoken on the phone and stuff? You had the Zoom calls and things, didn't you? Because if I go a full day without speaking to people, I do start sounding very weird very quickly.
I've had, like, 3 Zoom calls in the last week.
All right, that's good.
Not including this one, but yeah, apart from that, I haven't spoken to another human in person since Christmas Day.
Because you sorted out all your food deliveries and that, didn't you? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, no, I had a food delivery the day after Boxing Day. I guess I spoke to him. I don't really remember it.
Oh, yeah, no, I just mean you haven't had to go to the shops.
Yeah, no, I haven't gone to the shops. I haven't gone anywhere. So,
nice.
Fun times. We're going to see if I can do words today. So, note on spoilers, this is a spoiler-light podcast. Obviously, we're not on a Discworld book, but we may end up talking about the Discworld, so...
Yeah, I might just randomly throw some spoilers in for the late Discworld books as we discuss this early Pratchett novel.
I mean, let's not do that because we're a spoiler-light podcast.
Oh, right, yeah, that's it. Okay, so obviously, I won't do that.
Heavy spoilers for the book we're on, The Dark Side of the Sun. But we
My New Year's resolution is to be more of a twat.
You're doing well.
Thank you.
You're a delight.
I'm a delight.
But we will avoid spoiling any major future events in the Discworld novels, and we are saving any and all discussion of the final Discworld book, The Shepherd's Crown, until we get there, so you, dear listener, can come on the journey with us.
Through interspace, experiencing very strange folkloric hallucinations.
And with anti-gravity skates.
Yay!
Which I really liked the idea of for like 2 minutes, and then I thought about how much I would skate into walls if I had them.
But the scope of the walls, you could finally find out what's in the corners.
I don't want to find out what's in the corners, Francine.
Yeah, no, that's true. Yeah.
It's mostly spiders and I'm terrified
of them.
I would
be out of excuses not to dust. What are we talking about? We are talking about The Dark Side of the Sun.
We are. We haven't got anything to follow up on, have we? Apart from happy year of the beleaguered badger to all of our listeners.
Yeah. Oh, one small bit of very, very belated follow-up. In one of the books, one of the early gooses, one of the early books, there was a character called Virid Wazy Goose.
Oh, yeah.
And we were like, that's a fun nonsense name. But today, while I was looking through Brewers for something else entirely, I found out that Wazy Goose is like a kind of picnic or feast and was especially is associated with publishers. So Pratchett would have known that name.
Excellent.
So that is extremely belated follow-up from possibly one of the first couple of books.
Yep. I don't remember which book Virid Wazy Goose was in. It feels like it was a Rincewind.
Yeah, definitely. But this one here is even earlier. This is the second novel, which is only preceded by The Carpet People.
Mm.
This one was written in 1974, but not released until 1976. It is not as heavy-handed a genre parody, I'd say, as The Colour of Magic. It's sci-fi rather than fantasy, but it's more a pastiche. And stands alone quite nicely as a sci-fi story, even though there's obviously a lot of wink-nod elements in it.
Mm.
I quite liked one review which said, I can forecast an excellent future for the author if he can only bring off the difficult feat of curbing ever so slightly the riotous imagination which enables him to write sci-fi in the first place.
Interesting.
From the Western Daily Press, which I think Pratchett used to work for. Instead of doing that, he veered off into fantasy. I put in the show notes, I don't know if you can see it, the show plan rather,
the picture.
The original cover. Yeah, that was done by Pratchett.
Yeah.
He painted that. That's the last one he did.
So. Yeah. It's a lovely image. This is, so the book has these planets where there is no actual living stuff. Everything is robotic. And it's this sort of image of robotic bees and flowers.
It is. It's a really cool picture. I like it a lot. It makes me want to start trying to paint sci-fi things, which is a new direction to try and watercolour. Will not work at all, but let's have fun trying.
Oh, I want watercolour robots.
But yeah, I think it was reasonably successful, wasn't it? Fairly short print run.
It was well received and became...
I think it got him some attention from influential people.
Yeah, especially from sci-fi people. And it had a couple of much bigger print runs after Discworld started taking off as well.
That makes sense, yeah. Thank you, as always, to Mark Burrows for doing all that research for me so I can get to the correct chapter.
I was about to say one of the handy bits about, obviously, I consulted the Oracle that is the Mark Burrows book.
All right. Down a notch. We all know that Taylor Swift is the Oracle.
Mark's like a tiny Oracle. Oraclet.
An Oraclet. Oh, yay.
No, I consulted the book, and one of the handy things was it pointed out which sci-fi tropes were being mocked and which hadn't become tropes yet, because obviously this is the 70s.
Yeah, no, and that something I'd kind of picked out as Douglas Adam-esque was before The Hitchhiker's Guide, so.
Yeah, this is pre-Hitchhikers.
Yeah. Overall, I liked the book a lot more than I was expecting to from the first few pages.
Yeah.
I did as you suggested and just let it wash over me. And I'll say that at the beginning, because I highly recommend that for every other reader as well.
Yeah, it was a little bit hard to get into because I was trying really, because my way of episode planning is to read the book in its entirety and then go back through and do the post-its for the section we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And then go back through a third time to actually plan the episode from the post-its. So that first read, I was doing it between Christmas and New Year in the kind of weird hungover funk. And B, yeah, I don't read a lot of sci-fi, and so much is happening and so much is introduced really early on that I found kind of letting my brain unlatch a bit and just enjoying the story was the best way to enjoy the book.
Yeah, yeah. Agreed. Cool. So where do we start? Hold on, I've got my notes and I've got the show plan in front of me. There we go.
Shall I tell us what happened in this section?
Yes, summarise. In the first six chapters.
Yes, so we've got chapters.
Your edition, that's page 131, and in mine it's 70-something, but I suppose that doesn't matter because we've got chapters. That's nice.
Yes, so chapters 1 to 6 is this section.
Yeah, but ending before 6.
Well, ending at the end of 6.
May not have read the last chapter.
It's fine. That'll
make
it. I may
have done and I may not have done. Hold on. Sorry, you go and summarise. I'll just make sure I did read that bit. I think I
Excellent. Okay, so chapter 1 opens on Dom Sabalus involving his last day of freedom before he becomes chairman of the board. Apologies in advance for my attempts at pronouncing all of these names. As he rides a Dagon and visits a Joker Tower, we learn about the mysterious Jokers that appear to have left the universe. A strange attack leaves Dom semi-conscious in the ooze, tended to by a Pylax smuggler 40 miles offshore. Collected by security, Dom heads back to the family home, accompanied by a small swamp ig. We learn some Sabalus family history as Dom chats to Corridor, the head of security, and Hirschen, his phnobic tutor. Hirsch's fear and pity make the young chairman quite ill at ease. In chapter 2, Corridor talks to Joan, Dom's grandmother, and we learn that Dom is almost certainly fated to die the next day. Dom wakes on his birthday with only a hazy recollection of the previous day. His sister, Kasia, visits to join the investiture celebrations and gives him Isaac, a class 5 robot. Dom breakfasts alone with expensive simplicity as Corridor keeps an eye out. Corridor and Joan watch the guest arrives and discuss security measures as Dom opens his gifts. Tragically, at the end of the chapter, another attempt on Dom's life leads to Corridor making a noble sacrifice. In chapter 3, Dom lies in pseudo-death, dreaming of his father as his body is rebuilt from green goo-goo, and we learn that his recovery has taken 4 months and he heads home again. In chapter 4, Dom and his grandmother discuss nerves and the nature of fate. A memory cube from John, Dom's father, reveals Dom's destiny to survive fate and discover the mysterious home of the Jokers. His grandmother does not approve. Another attempt on Dom's life is foiled as fate saves him once again. Dom heads to the Buraku to find his tutor, Hirschhug. He thwarts the attempts of grandmother's security to bring him home. With Hirschhug, Isaac the robot, and Ig in tow, Dom heads for the family yacht to go Joker hunting. In chapter 5, Dom continues to defy his grandmother, and a ragtag bunch of misfits head for Bank.
We got there.
With the aid of a sundog. We learn about the creepy Yai, a mysterious race searching for the meaning of life. A Joker Tower and another assassination attempt caused the Sundog to drop the yacht. And in chapter 6, arriving at Bank, a huge human planet, Dom handles some financials before asking to speak with the Conscious Bank, his godfather. As he waits, he spots a strange, wealthy-looking man watching him, accompanied by a rubbish robot. The bank explains to Dom that his continued survival has created a new universe of probability, and he has around 27 days to find the home of the Jokers. Dom's conversation with the bank is cut short as his grandmother tracks him down, and he makes his escape and heads off to continue his journey.
Right, so I didn't read chapter 6.
Well, now you know what happens.
Yes, no, that is useful. But yeah, no, that's fine. That's fine. I actually stopped myself from reading the entire thing last night, not because podcast, but because it was very late at night and I'm trying to get my sleep schedule back on.
Yeah, that's fine.
Before I go back to work. But I got so into it that, yeah.
Well, as you have only read the first half of the book, I will try and not spoil the second half.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I don't mind particularly, but you never know, someone might be reading along as well. You know me, I don't care about spoilers. Yeah, this is, should have mentioned right at the beginning, the first time I've read this.
Yeah, ditto. Yeah. I've had a copy of it sat on my shelf for ages. I've always meant to, but just never got around to it.
Well, I think I read the first few pages once and I picked it up because I wanted to read Pratchett. And
yeah.
Because I was probably in a shit mood or something. And was like, no, do you know what? This is not what I wanted. Put it down, pick up Small Gods or something like that.
Yeah. Like I said, it took me a minute to get into, but once I got into it, it did all feel very Pratchett-y.
Yeah, definitely.
It's early and you can...
It makes me wish he'd written more sci-fi.
Yeah, I would love to read even more just set in this universe.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So, quote...
It's a little bit Neil Asher-y almost.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, quotes.
I'm pretty sure yours is before mine. Obviously, we've got completely different page numbers.
Yeah, mine is his first assassination attempt. The ball of non-light spun up above the blackened lawn and the landscape twisted. CY was a bright sun. In the painfully light sky, it showed now as a darker speck. Just thought that was a fantastic bit of imagery.
That is brilliant. That's a great moment. Mine is...
Like, that whole scene is just the sudden chaos is pretty expertly pulled off. But yeah, just that line in particular.
Yeah, that's something completely out of nowhere is brilliant.
Yeah. So how about you?
Mine is when they are travelling in Interspace.
Oh, yeah.
Dom knew about the things seen in Interspace. The larger ships usually had screening around most of the hull and perhaps an unscreened lounge for the incurably curious. A white stag galloped through the cabin wall, which glowed under an orange light. It bore a gold crown between its horns. Dom sensed its fear, smelled the rankness, saw the sweat-matted hair on its flanks. But its hooves merged with the floor, and the floor and skin merged and flowed continuously. It reared and leapt through the auto chef. Dom saw the huntsman on his black horse when he brushed through the wall of the drive cabin like bracken. He wore white except for a red cloak hung with silver bells, and his face beneath yellow hair that billowed in an intangible wind was pale and set. For a moment he looked at Dom, who saw his eyes gleam momentarily like mirrors and a hand go up protectively. Then the horse and rider were gone.
Yeah.
It's just such it's just a beautiful bit of prose.
Yes.
But it's such a, in a very heavy sci-fi novel, that moment of...
Earth
fantasy
folklore.
Yeah, a very earthy folklorey moment.
Did you look into it, by the way?
I didn't. I thought about it, and I tried to avoid rabbit holes for this one.
Oh yeah, I did not. Like, you'll know anyway, like, white stags are found in various folklore. I couldn't find if this was a specific story of like a white stag stealing a king's crown or something. I couldn't find it. But white stags are used as warning signs from the other world. Like, in the first like prose ever found in Britain, there was a collection of Welsh stories, and it appears warning the protagonist to stop hunting on the grounds of one of the kings of the other world. So this could be like that. And it also popped up a lot in Arthurian legend as like this thing that was never caught. So I thought both of them were a bit on theme. Or it could, of course, just be this beautiful imagery that Pratchett has absorbed through many types of folklore. And
yeah, that's quite fair.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed that moment, especially.
Yeah, absolutely. It was very evocative.
Okay, so characters. Okay.
Characters.
So obviously our main man, Dom Sabalos.
Yes. Thank God you can pronounce his name.
I really should have listened to an audiobook of this just to get all of the pronunciations of the names down, but I didn't, so we're improvising.
I was thinking, like, I probably shouldn't spend a few quid just to hear somebody else try and say this, so I won't, but I did think about it, yeah.
At the end of the day, it's a fictional sci-fi thing. Technically, there is no correct way to pronounce it, so I'm going to make it all up. But yeah,
technically, so this is, correct's the best kind.
This is very much coming-of-age story.
Yeah.
There's obviously tragic loss of a parent in his history, which is necessary for a young boy coming of age.
Yeah.
I quite like him as a protagonist. He's not massively well-rounded, but he's not...
He is... as pleasant as you could expect someone in his situation to turn out.
Yeah.
And that's nice. But he still has, like, very much the streaks of teenage boy silliness, which is...
He's got the well done. Victor Tugelbend, Mort, that sort of gang of Pratchett characters. He's got that little vibe.
But it's a bit more competent, I think.
Yes, he is surprisingly competent and quite confident as well.
Yes.
And you've got sort of the whole background of the Sabalos family and this idea of a planet being ruled by Bord.
Yeah. I like how they made his family kind of unsympathetic and sympathetic at the same time. Like, it does fit in well with how his character is.
Yeah.
That was a really shit sentence, but you know what I mean.
They are well-meaning, but they are automatically incredibly privileged.
Yes,
made quite a lot of money on this planet Widdershins and effectively rule it because they got very lucky in the things that they found.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and that's like a family trait.
Yeah, which is, well, yeah, the sort of luck and fate working out quite well is the family trait.
Yeah.
And then we've got Corridor.
Excellent.
Corridore. I'm going with Corridor.
Yeah.
It's fine.
I think it's almost, knowing Pratchett's later work, Corridor sounds about right.
Yeah. So he's the head of security. And his job is basically keeping Dom safe, despite Dom trying to evade him at all times. So he's got tiny little pin robots everywhere, and he's very anxious. But one thing I wanted to talk about with him is, I was about to say spoilers, but like literally this is the bit of the book we're talking about. When he dies, there's this huge explosion at Dom's investiture ceremony, and Corridor ends up sacrificing himself to save Dom. Like, that's how devoted he is to his job and this family.
Yeah.
But it's very, it just sort of happens. And it's not,
it's not the source of any angst afterwards.
It's not the source of any angst. No one really talks about him again. No one misses him. And it's just not treated with much gravity. And I think that's a kind of, I know this is early Pratchett and I know it's not Discworld, but a bit of me half expected a Grim Reaper character to show up. But even without that, like, Pratchett is normally quite good. We talked about in Witches Abroad how jarring it was when the Beatles were killed without much thought.
Yeah.
He normally treats death with such solemnity that for a character to just sort of be killed off and then forgotten about is...
Yeah, I suppose that's where the kind of the fact it's pastiche of the genre might come in, because space opera is very much like, vaporized, everyone's vaporized.
And this is very much space opera type sci-fi, which is very, very 70s.
Yes. But like a nice example of it. I've read... Right at the beginning, we talked about how you've read quite a lot more pulp fantasy than I have. And I think the other way around here, I've read quite a lot more pulp sci-fi than you have.
You have read a lot more pulp sci-fi than
I have. And it's like, considering it's a pastiche of it, it's much better than most of it, just even as a standalone thing.
Yeah, I'm enjoying it. I am. But I found
that... But yes, no, I see what you mean. Definitely.
I just think it's interesting to look at how that shifted in Pratchett's writing going forward.
Yeah, I think in a few years he would have
made more of that moment.
Yeah, even if it was just a reflective paragraph afterwards.
Yeah, or just Dom having a moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then we've got the grandmother, Joan, who's...
I like Joan.
I like her because she's this big matriarch, and no matter who's got the title chairman, she's really in control and in charge.
The fact she packed off her father to live on the other side of the planet when he got too much.
Yeah. I also quite like, you know, she's effectively the antagonist for the first half of for the latter half of this section.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
She's trying to chase Dom and bring him home. She doesn't want him trying to track down the Joker's world because she wants him to stay alive.
But like a well-meaning antagonist.
Yeah.
Whose side you're allowed to see.
Yeah. And she's got this whole cool-heading thing she keeps doing, which is a way people can switch off their emotions, basically.
Yeah. The sinistral incense they use for it.
Yeah.
I quite liked that because sinister, obviously, meaning left. And left brain, I'm guessing, it's a reference to.
And then
left
also...
left brain's the like analytical one, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah. And right brain's the creative one.
Yeah.
But also...
And that might be bullshit.
Yeah. Also, the planet is Widdershin, so you've got kind of left and anti-clockwise. And...
Oh, well done, yeah.
So that all kind of ties in together. And then who else do we have? So we have Hershug.
Yep.
The phonobic tutor.
Hershug.
I like him. Mm-hmm. We have, I'm not going to go massively into all of these because there's so many.
Yeah.
You've got Ig, the little swamp pig.
Oh, I was so happy when he was okay.
He's
I was
so
like,
cute.
You did not just kill off a little pet that you just let me know.
Don't
fine,
kill
off the devoted head of security. See if I care. Do not kill the little rat friend.
Yes, but no. They don't kill the small rat friend. There is a depiction. So I've got the Kirby illustrations. I'm assuming you do as well.
On the cover, you mean?
Yeah. And again, I'm not sure how I feel about the cover, especially the scantily clad, large-breasted woman.
Oh, we might have different covers.
Shall we? Really? Oh, we've got very different covers.
Yeah, mine looks like a Kirby as well, doesn't it? But it's... Mine is like impenetrable. Yeah, it is Kirby. I can see his signature. Mine's impenetrable sci-fi rather than any naked ladies.
Show me again,
but hold it further away. Sorry.
Hang on a sec. Let me put myself back on. So I can see what I'm
We'll showing. Post pictures of all of these various covers. Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I like my version better.
I think mine's a much later edition.
Mm.
Yours
was that was probably released to fit more in with the...
With the Discworld covers, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, Ig, the very sweet little swamp dragon. We've got Keja, the sister, and
swamp dragon. Did you just call him?
Oh God, he is basically a swamp dragon.
He is basically a swamp dragon. Did you notice he's like the various descriptions of him? He's a hermaphrodite. He lays eggs, and he's polyco something, but that means he can change temperature quite a lot.
Yeah, and so, he's got three sets of legs, none of them the same. Yeah.
Basically a rat platypus swamp dragon.
Yeah, I like it. I want one. Keja, who is married to someone called Ptarmigan.
Which is a bird.
Yes, I knew that. I definitely didn't have to Google it.
Me neither.
We have got the smart aleck robot companion, Isaac.
Good old Isaac.
There's one bit about Isaac. I'm just finding the page.
Do you reckon he's named after Asimov or Newton?
I'm going Asimov.
Yeah.
I think this is around the time that you would name a robot after Isaac Asimov.
Would you ever not?
Good point. Dom really doesn't want to actually own the robot and sign the paperwork saying he owns him because it's and is uncomfortable about it. And the robot's like, no, I don't want to own myself. And the quote, "We robots know exactly why we were created, boss. No striving to find the innermost secrets of our creation." And Dom says, "Don't you want to be free?" And he says, "What, and have God blame the universe on me?"
Yeah. It gave me a little bit of a hint of house elf slave race kind of rubbish, but...
Yeah, a little bit.
But I'll take it as he's a robot, I guess. Oh, no. Now I'm going to get into the worrying about AI rights in my spare time.
No, we're not worrying about AI.
Anyway, I like him. He's a good character.
I like it because it ties in with one of the big central themes of this, which is this idea of fate and how you live your life if everything is fated. And one of my big theories about people who really embrace religion, it's partly as an abdication of responsibility.
Yes.
Because it's all God's doing, not your own.
Yes.
So that perspective of it, of if I think of myself as truly human and own myself, then the universe is my responsibility.
Yeah.
And I don't want to have God blame the universe on me. I think that ties in quite nicely to the central theme of the book.
Yes.
And to my thoughts on religion.
Yes.
Which are varied and mostly angry.
Mm. And then we have Lady Bian.
Lady Vianne, the
Dom's mum.
Yes, the sort of absent mother figure who drifts in wearing a large veil and gives a gift and sort of.
Yeah, because she seems to live on this hot planet. I'm imagining her very like Southern Belle kind of.
Oh yeah.
You know, plantation aristocrat rubbish.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry, my ankle's just seized up.
Which would make sense, actually, because that seems to be the kind of background of the...
There's definitely a vibe of that, especially considering this is such a swampy planet.
Yeah.
Charles Subluna, who is... actually, one of the plot points about Charles Subluna isn't revealed until a later bit. You haven't read him.
Okay.
Because this is in the chapter you haven't read. He is... But you will have seen his name, so some of the quotes from books within the universe that are used for exposition.
Yeah.
Books are by then. He is a poet, polymath, and soldier of fortune.
I want that on a business card.
Absolutely, so do I. That's why I included him here.
You deserve it more than I do. And then, we've got to write down these business cards. I'm going to make you a whole set of like ridiculous ones to give out to people one day.
Excellent, thank you. And then this one, is bridging the gap between character and locations, and that is the first Syrian bank.
Yeah.
Who is a planet-spanning consciousness who has made himself, A, into a bank, and B, acquired human status.
Yes. I like how he addresses the kind of lack of care that someone who's basically immortal would have. I think a lot of sci-fi doesn't do that and makes their immortal beings genuinely concerned with the petty nothings of human drama. And that always stands out to me. And I like that he kind of says, well, no, he's probably just fucking with us. Like,
yeah, he's got what the fuck else is he going to do? But yes, he insists that he is classed as human.
Mm-hmm.
He is alive and possessed of a universe view sufficiently advanced to call him human. One of my favourite moments with him, though, and again, you haven't read to this section because you've missed
the chapter. It's fine. You can spoil anything you like about chapter.
It's not really a spoiler. He speaks in small capitals. It's very death.
Oh, yay.
That's a sort of proto-Discworldy moment.
I love small caps.
But he's sort of in his desk. There's a robot, or at his desk, there is a robot so that there is a humanoid thing to speak to, because obviously the consciousness spans the whole planet, covered in wires. And the robot smokes a cigar. And he says, I mean, it's not really an affectation, but it just puts some people at ease if there's something humanoid smoking a cigar. That's more relaxing to converse with than a planet-sized computer.
That's very 70s businessman, isn't it?
It's very 70s businessman, and it is. I think that's one of the more parody bits of the book.
Yeah,
of course, the planet-spanning consciousness is actually smoking a cigar. Also, planet-spanning consciousness, cool band name, very Douglas Adams.
Planet spanning consciousness. Also could go on a business card.
Excellent. Answers on a business card. And then locations, obviously we've got the planet Widdershins that we begin on.
Yeah. Which is clearly, at this point, just a word Pratchett liked that he's seen in various places.
Well, like I said, it ties into lots of sort of anti-clockwise and left-handed things throughout the book.
Yeah,
it's just like
true.
Nice bit of odd.
Yeah.
And we don't go to many places in this. So we have Widdershins, we end up at the bank, we spend time on the yacht. But one of the places on the planet Widdershins is the Buruku, which is where the Fnobes live.
Yes.
And it is dressed with the soil of the home planet of the Fnobes, because that's quite sacred to them.
Yeah. Did we find out where that planet is yet by the end of part one?
Where the Fnobic planet?
Yeah, it's near. It's like it's within this bubble of planets.
It is within this bubble.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly where. I haven't got a map.
But they weren't like living there when the humans turned up, or did they turn up at the same time? Or
I think a similar time.
Okay, I should go back and reread some of it. I read a lot of this after midnight on two separate nights. I went back and reread because I didn't quite absorb some of it, and then it was past midnight again. So
yeah, that's fair. There are whole sections that kind of list what order the planets evolved in and the races evolved in and how they all came to know each other and travel between planets and blah, blah, blah. But I thought if I marked those, I'd end up just reading out massive passages of the book. And Our listeners can read the book for themselves, gosh darn it.
We believe in you.
Go on, guys, you can do
it.
Dear
little legs.
Dear little listeners on their dear little legs.
I assume all of our listeners are grasshoppers who listen with their legs.
Yeah, that tracks. That absolutely tracks. So, little bits.
Little bits we liked.
Little bits we liked. First one being the name of the thing in the thing. Gotta love the name of the thing being in the thing.
Oh, yeah. What context is that?
This is the poem that was the first piece of the Joker's writing to be translated with the help of a poet and a mad computer.
Yes.
You who stand before us, we have held the stars in the hollow of our hands, and the stars burn. Pray be careful now as to how you handle them. We have gone to wait on our new world. There is but one, and it lies at the dark side of the sun.
Bit derivative, innit?
Yep.
Couplet's more like singlet.
Yeah, so this is the sort of prophecy that's being followed to try and find the Joker's world.
Yeah. Which is cute. And obviously a reference to the dark side of the moon, which...
Yeah, there was a nice bit in Mark's book about the title, like, cause this was written the same year that Dark Side of the Moon came out, and that it nearly had a different title because, funnily enough, quite a lot of sci-fi authors were titling books with parodies of Dark Side of the Moon.
Yeah. Nerds!
Fucking nerds. And then one of the other bits I liked was, especially in the opening first few chapters, there's just quite a lot of one-on-one dialogues.
Okay.
There's so lots of, so you have Dom and the Pylax smuggler, you have lots of Corridor and Joan, you have Dom and his sister, Dom and the robot. And I like that as a structure thing. I really love it. To wildly off topic, but Game of Thrones, the early seasons, has lots of these amazing one-on-one dialogue scenes.
Okay.
That it kind of lost as the budget got bigger in favor of big dramatic battles and things. And it's a shame because I really think the dialogue was one of the things the show did really well.
It's good for character building, relationship building, exposition, all of that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I like it here as well because I can't help but read something like this without thinking about how I'd adapt it. And I think that would make a really good opening half hour if you were doing, because this would be a movie, this wouldn't work as a TV series.
Yeah.
But an opening half hour of lots of those dialogues interspersed with the occasional big dramatic violent moments, because it's sort of punctuated by the attempts on Dom's life.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's an interesting way to structure it. So I like those. And then obviously there's lots of little proto Discworld bits.
Yeah, for sure.
Including the first reference I noticed isn't a Discworld reference. I mean, they're not references because the Discworld didn't exist. There's a reference to something else, and I like that a Lord of the Rings reference got shoehorned even into the sci-fi book.
Oh?
When Dom is dreaming as he's being rebuilt and he's having a conversation with the robot, and the robot's sort of doing all these sarcastic answers of, oh, this is your destiny, this is your destiny. If you want it straight from the shoulder, you're not important at all, but you happen to have this magic bracelet, which was made by the god of the universe, and he wants it back, and you're going to get together a few trusted friends and travel many a weary light year to the searing fires of Rigel.
Yeah.
So I like it because that whole section has lots of plays on these are tropey things in novels.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But then you've also got
one of those bits where Pratchett's like, oh, I'm going to shove in a whole bunch of stuff I want to in here for funsies.
It's a very fun page. You've got the idea of assassins and assassination. I know that's not specifically Discworld, but it's definitely a theme that Pratchett does come back to in the Discworld quite heavily.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of the thoughts on knowing who's assassinating you and whether you should look up or not is definitely very...
Yeah, for sure.
And then there's a whole page, I think it's 67 in mine, where you've got reference to Soul Cake Friday.
Yeah.
Which eventually in the Discworld books will become Soul Cake Tuesday. The Eve of Small Gods, and that's definitely the next Discworld book we're going to be doing, is called Small Gods. There's the idea of a clatch, and that's a word that will obviously come back as a location. Even Hogswatch Night is mentioned.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see if there's anything else I found for, like, oh, the year names, like the, what was it? It's a named year along the same theme.
Yeah, there's a few of those.
So it's the year of the questing monkey was when the planet was settled.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. No, there's clearly a bunch of ideas that he's then going to spread out a bit later.
Yeah, the big thematic one, which is kind of the theme of the whole book, the idea that Dom survives these assassination attempts means they are on this one timeline in all of the different multiverses.
Yeah.
And the actual line, a student of probability soon realizes that by its nature, the billion to one chance crops up 9 times out of 10.
Yes.
And then obviously that's the theme that comes back quite heavily in the Discworld. So that one made me smile.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I noticed as well, there's quite a lot of proto Long Earth stuff in here.
Yeah.
So the term Jokers
will eventually get reused in the Long Earth.
Yeah, will be used not as a species, but as a type of universe. The idea that the universe you're in at the moment is called Datum, that's straight out of Long Earth. Just the whole idea of the universe is stretching out on either side of you is very that.
Well, there's a nice little... So the Long Earth series only... When I can't remember when the first one came out now, but it's comparatively recent. In the last couple of decades.
Yeah, the I've got the hardbacks.
So it was between 2010 and 2020.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact years. But the idea for the series existed much longer. There's an anecdote in Mark's book where after Equal Rights, apparently Terry Pratchett was talking to Neil Gaiman and said, oh, I've got this idea for this series, and outlined basically the first Long Earth book.
Yeah.
And Neil Gaiman said, that's great, but I think at some point you should come back to this Death character. He's my favourite. And Terry Pratchett apparently phoned him back and went, you bastard, the next one's called Mort.
Yeah. Which is good because he ended up collaborating with Stephen Baxter on it, and Stephen Baxter's a very, very good sci-fi writer.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people don't like, a lot of Discworld fans don't like The Long Earth, I think probably for this reason, because the structure is very Baxter. And I think a lot of the heart and the ideas and the energy is very Pratchett, but it's written as a sci-fi.
Yeah, the characters are very Pratchett, but it is within a very sci-fi structure. I think they're great books.
Yeah, I fucking love them. But then again, I was a fan of Baxter's anyway, and I like this kind of sci-fi. So
I've never read any other Stephen Baxter, and I really ought to.
I'll send you recommendations for a good couple. You'd like he's very prolific. But
thank you. And yeah, there's some Doug. We were already saying there's lots of Douglas Adams-esque stuff.
Yeah. I think my favorite line along those lines was, on the other side of the yacht was the rest of the universe, composed almost entirely of nothing, with a trace of hydrogen. by which means all of existence, which predates Hitchhiker's Guide by a few years, but you would believe it was taken straight from it if you hadn't read this.
They definitely both, you can tell they were written around similar times and both by very clever, very funny people doing sci-fi.
Yeah.
A lot of the things I was noticing as Douglas Adams-esque are really just big 70s sci-fi tropes. I think I probably would have another level of appreciation for this book if I'd read more 70s sci-fi, to be perfectly honest.
Well, reading a lot more 70s sci-fi is a big commitment to just get another level of this short book, so I think you're all right.
Yeah, I didn't do a lot of supplementary reading around it because there are a finite number of hours in the day, and I have got to spend a lot of those eating snacks. That is mostly what I've done for the last week. I've just eaten a lot of snacks.
Yes. What else have we got in little bits?
Sun dogs.
Oh, like sun dogs. Yes. I just thought it was a nice concept. And in particular, I liked when they were taking off for the first time. It goes, to be ready, to be steady, go. Just.
I enjoyed the sun dogs. They've got great names as well.
What is it? Abramelin Lincoln stroke NO Barbus stroke 50.3 NO Barbus McMyrmidon. This McMyrmidon. One is called McMyrmidon. Yeah.
The second half of the catchy book has a lot more insight into sort of their culture and existence. As
oh, does
well.
It? Oh, good.
I think you'll really
like
the
sun dogs. Good. Good. Oh, I don't have time to read this today, but I really want to just finish the book. So much to do.
So on to the bigger stuff. And the thing that really struck me the most about this, or the thing I enjoyed the most, was the world building.
Yeah.
It is such a thoroughly realized world in such a few pages.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about his world building in relation to the Discworld and the kind of slow burn of it, how he, you can see him build more and more layers onto this place he's creating as the books go on, which a lot of has to do with the fact that it's such a long series that you can keep adding layers to it.
Yeah.
Whereas this is the opposite. This is a slam. Here is the world.
Yeah. I think it was kind of inexpertly done in the first bit of the book. The fact that he tried to kind of mention as many things in the first 10 pages as possible.
Yeah, the Dagons and the Blue Flamingos and everything at once. I think that's quite a common sci-fi thing. Is
it is, it is, absolutely. And it always makes me go, oh. So if he's doing a pastiche, he wasn't wrong to do it, but it did make me go, oh, not this shit.
The idea of this kind of proto-race that has since disappeared is a very common sci-fi trope. The Jokers, there are versions of it across so many different sci-fi stories, but I think it's well done here.
Yeah, I like that the rest of it, I like the rest of the exposition and the world building. Just that first few pages was a bit annoying for me.
Yeah.
I love all of the random tangents into literature and lectures and...
Yeah, I like heavy-handed exposition in something like this. I'd much rather something almost gave me like a textbook of, okay, here is the world, now here is the story in it.
Yes.
But that dive in where it's like, okay, here's a person and he's doing a weird thing, but I'm going to write about it like it's normal because it is for this world.
Yes.
That I really struggle with.
Yeah, and it can be very well done. But I think this was a few too many things too quickly, and it certainly put me off the first term, and I would guess it would put a few readers off.
Once it settles into the story and starts giving you the actual pages of exposition.
Yes. Once Don was basically on the raft, I was great. Good from there. Literally just the first few pages. I was like, oh, you're doing fucking what? What's that? Oh, the sun has a different name, does it? Great.
Yeah.
Is that necessary?
I like that the book doesn't force you to learn all of it as well.
Yeah, I think that was my problem. I was trying to internalize it.
Yeah, which, like I said, unlatch and let the book wash over you and it becomes a much more enjoyable experience.
Yeah.
There's so many different races, but they are quite nicely sort of outlined. So you've got the humans, humanoids, who are slightly differently evolved depending on the planets they've grown up in. Like on Widdershins, because of the high UV, everyone is black and hairless.
Yeah, although that was partly because of injections as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Mentioned, which I was glad it did, because I was like, I don't think you'd evolve that quickly over four generations, even if they're long generations. But
they've established extras. There's a good page that on 98.99 in my book, I'm not sure what it would be in yours, that goes just through all of the different races in detail. Yeah. So you've got man, Fnobes, Drosks, Spooners, obviously the Creepy. I quite like how quickly
I was definitely reading it creepy.
Because it's two eyes, I'm not sure if it's like, maybe it's creepy eye.
Creepy. Great. Do you usually pronounce two eyes eye?
I have no idea.
Never mind. It's not important.
It's not. I really like when an entire cultural belief is established with really small details.
Mm.
So the Fnobes have Fnobes like Hershen, who is a scholar. He's a philosopher and he studies probability. He's reading the Stoics at one point.
Yeah.
And then you have the alpha male types who are a lot flashier, and Hershen has to pretend to be one and is really uncomfortable with it.
Yeah.
But when small details are used to really establish the nature of a culture, so one of them being when they go into interspace and all the sort of illusions happen.
Yeah.
The quote I had earlier, Dom quite enjoys it. Fnobe, I've written down the wrong page number, but Hershen is horrified by it. He's hiding under the table. He's scared because for him it's like, well, what if I become untethered from reality and cease to exist?
Yeah.
And because he spends so much time thinking about the nature of reality, I found it very relatable.
Yeah. They were the cerebral race.
Yeah.
And he says humans clearly more resilient. And at this point, it's because you don't think about it as much. Yeah.
Yeah. You don't think about what happens if you stop existing quite as often. Yeah. And then the creepy eye, who are what we're calling them, who are this big cerebral race who evolved very slowly. to think about things. It's almost like a race of deep thought.
Yeah. I think I want to talk about it a lot more, so I was saving it for next week, but I like the kind of glimpse into the different kinds of life and the fact that there's a lot that you can't even comprehend, that maybe this race can comprehend this race, and so we can use them as a go-between and all of that. Like,
yeah, these sort of little links between the different...
Yeah, that's one of my favourite sci-fi tropes when it's well done.
Yeah. Creating entire races in general and establishing a whole culture for them, again, with the Fnobes and the Buruku and the fact that they need to live on their own sacred ground.
Yeah.
All of those little details make me really enjoy this, the world building of this, because it's not just, this is a race and this is what they're like, and it's more, this is a race and because they're like this, they do this.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, see, for me, like, I enjoy that, but I almost care. I think I care about the culture and the details of their race less than I do the idea that he hints that there's more forms of life out there that we just can't properly look at. Like, I'm like, yay, that's a nice species with a cool culture, but what about these ones we can't comprehend? Obviously we can't, so we can't go into it, but I like the idea that they're there.
I can't wait to become uncomprehendable. Some of our listeners might say I'm there already.
Might be a plan. So
you had something about the types of exposition as well, was that?
Yeah, I think that's basically what I've been kind of talking about already, just the difference between having the textbook dropped in there and the kind of mention of I'm here, allow me to use my totally normal clam sail. both can be good when used well. I think he did the
former
dropping in better than he did the in-context one.
Yeah, just the throwing things at everyone.
Yeah. He's already, like, showing obvious signs of being Pratchett, unsurprisingly, as he is, and in his late 20s already. But just, you can tell how well and miscellaneously read he is by the references he's dropping in everywhere already.
Yeah,
so folklore and myth and everything on top of all the sci-fi, he's like, can't help himself, he's got to add in
the folkloric stuff
and I feel like this is the other thing I'll probably talk about more next week, but the religion he's built for it, I feel like is an excuse to put in as many esoteric references as he could.
Yeah, this is the Sardimism.
Yes, which is, when you read it out loud in your head, when you read it, you're like, you can't say that in a good way.
Sadism.
Sadism, yeah, let's call it sadism, which is some kind of environmental thing anyway. But just the various references throughout. I mean, the fact that his grandmother's dressed in, what do you call it, nocticular Hecate robes, which, like, Hecate, obviously, but then Nocticulus is some fairly obscure, like, part of the moon goddess, I think, which is now used in, like, D&D-based folklore. But as far as I can tell, that all happened after this book. So he's read it in some fucking old books there. And then the knives they use is, like, a Thame, which is a ceremonial blade. And, like, Dagon is used for the first time here. And Dagon is half woman, half fish thing from some Philistine god. Yeah, this came up comes up elsewhere in Pratchett. I can't even remember which one now. It might be Men of Arms. With the cursed shop on Dagon Street.
See, I have this problem as well with a lot of the weird mythical and folkloric references.
Mm.
Bingo cards out, but Buffy.
Oh, Jesus. It's been a while.
Because there's lots of the paranormal stuff happening and witches doing spells and things, they will quite often, it looks like they've gone through an old copy of Brewers and just randomly pointed at something. So there'll be prayers to Hecate or Hecate.
Yeah.
There's a thing called a Dagon sphere that's a very important plot point.
That's a woman fish sphere.
That makes a lot of sense in the context.
Yeah. Yeah, no, just it is what made it take quite a long time for me to read even the first half of this very short book, because
you want to look everything up.
Yeah, I want to look everything up. You know me. And yeah. Oh, this I also liked Mommet as the bit of his brain that you can rebuild from.
Yeah.
Which is like, there's like a voodoo doll, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. It's a...
Which I almost certainly also learned from Pratchett.
It's a doll that represents a human in some way.
Okay.
So not just within voodoo, but other versions of... It's like a catch-all term, I believe. I could be wrong. Listeners, let me know.
Answers on a...
Albatross.
Arcane stone.
Answers carved into an arcane stone that we will somehow come across in later years. Answers on an obelisk.
Answers on an obelisk planted in an ancient city several centuries ago.
Thank you.
Yeah. And the last talking point, last but definitely not least, is yours, which is the nature of fate and probability. Please do
go on about that nonsense. This is the theme of the book. There is this idea that there is a different universe for every different thing that could have happened.
Yeah.
And that Dom surviving his birthday was a billion to one chance, but has happened, and that's now put them on this particular universe's timeline where Dom is alive, and Dom keeps surviving and is apparently fated to find the Joker's world. The chapter that you haven't read, the bank goes into running probability things on him. And this whole idea of probability math ordaining things. And I just think it's really fascinating. I can't say that in a way that the listeners can even hear. The Pylax smuggler that rescues Dom at the beginning refers to it as beta, which is the phenobic concept of probability and fate.
Yeah.
There's an interesting... So Dom hasn't been made aware of probability math existing. He's been kept...
Yeah, he grasped it pretty fucking quickly though, didn't he?
Yeah. But Joan and Corridor have a conversation about it. And there's a really interesting... Corridor is basically saying, I know it's absolutely predicted he's going to die, but I suppose I'm hoping. I can't believe it 100%.
Yeah.
And it's that belief and it's that hope that allows Corridor to save him.
Yeah.
But he's saying, I can't pretend to understand it, but if the universe is so immutable that the future can be told by a handful of numbers, then why do we need to keep living? And Joan responds with, we go on because to live is still better to die. And that's always been the choice of humanity.
Mm.
And that is such an interesting thing, this idea of if everything is preordained, can you... What is the point of making a decision? You feel every, and obviously it's bollocks because you can't predict the future.
Or can you?
No.
Okay.
We're being sceptical, Francie.
Are we?
I am.
Don't know why you're bringing me on board.
Yes, because you are such a firm believer in things like believing the prediction.
Well,
the future.
As a Cancer, yes.
As a Gemini, I don't believe in star signs.
I philosophically speaking, am on board with Joan, because even if you can tell the future and everything's preordained, to live is better than to die, as we know.
Yep.
My fervent like desire alive. To never ever die.
Yeah, you've barely ever mentioned that.
Yeah, well, nearly as many times as you've never mentioned Buffy.
There's another line about it I really love as well, which is later when Dom is talking to the bank and he's sort of explaining, the bank is explaining, like, yes, this is the high probability. But do you know why you've decided you're going to go and look for the Jokers? And Dom says, well, it seems like the right thing to do now. It feels like the most right choice. And I'm not really sure why. And the bank responds with, well, you accepted fate. A philosophic drosk would say you heard today's echo of tomorrow's scream.
Oh, Jesus. All right.
But it's the central thing of this book is that
Dom
is completely allowing his life to be directed by what he's apparently fated to do. And that argument that comes sort of back again and again when you start thinking about fate and preordained things is, am I doing this because I've been told it's fated, or is this fated and that's why I'm doing this?
Self-fulfilling prophecy kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think having such a massive, lofty existential theme in a pastiche of pulp sci-fi written in the mid-70s is why I love Pratchett so much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for it's... It's almost surprising he never revisits the exact theme later.
Well, like I said, a bit of it comes back in this Millions One Chances idea.
Yeah. But the idea of, I'm sure the idea of self-fulfilling prophecy does as well. But as an almost cohesive theme, it doesn't, maybe he could never quite make it cohesive.
Yeah. But it works here. I think it works for this specific book. Yeah.
And tied in with probability and things, it is more sci-fi than fantasy. So I can.
Especially, the nature of calculating and.
Yeah. How much do you enjoy, know, whatever, probability, statistics?
I quite enjoy
that side of mathematics.
I did study it. Obviously, it's all quite a while ago since I've officially studied anything, but I did study statistics and probability.
Yeah.
Back when I was studying things. And it's always quite interested me because it's such a fallible area of mathematics.
Right.
Because there is never a way to account for every single variable.
Yes.
And it's such a...
And most people don't even try.
No.
Which is why statistics, down statistics, et cetera.
Statistics alone are not a great way to work things out. And correlation doesn't equal causation is always a fun thing to scream at people.
My dad has a PhD in statistics, so if you get him started, he will.
I've gotten into discussions of statistics with your dad and realised that there is just a lot I don't know.
Well, that's fair, considering you did A-level and, you did the...
No, GCSE, not even A-level.
Oh, okay, right. Oh, in theory, then, I also studied that. I don't remember.
I did it as an extra GCSE on top of my standard maths.
Gotcha, yeah.
I went to about 5 of the classes and got a B.
Oh, well then.
Yes. I remember when I was good at things. But yeah, so that's what I think I've enjoyed the most about reading this, as it's literally Pratchett's second novel.
Yeah.
And you can see the weaknesses in the writing, the dialogues, as much as I like all those one-on-ones, it's a bit clunky. The world building is fantastic, but this kind of heavy exposition you wouldn't get in a Discworld book.
Yeah.
But that big core of Pratchett of using this huge idea, sneaking it up on you during what is a fun pastiche in a fun genre, is very Pratchett-y.
Yeah, and more so, I'd say, than the first couple of his Discworld books.
Yeah. There was no big central background idea really running across Colour of Magic, certainly. I mean, like Fantastic had the villainy and the stupidity of people.
Yeah, which is so weaved throughout all of Pratchett's writing, it's hardly even a theme, is it?
It's just a fact at this
just
point.
Just an acknowledgement, But yeah, no, I am enjoying it so far. I will enjoy the rest of it when I'm meant to be doing something else later.
Excellent. Yeah. I'm so proud of you. But it's nice to come back and see where things started.
Yes.
I think that might end up being a bit of a theme-ish for this year. That we'll do more of looking at the early stuff and how we got to where we are.
Yeah. I've never read Johnny and the Dead. None of them. I've never read Strata. We've got some actual new ground to cover in amongst our big old reread, so that's nice.
I am quite looking forward to coming back because I haven't read a lot of the non-Discworld.
Yeah.
I've read Dodger, I've read Nation, I've read Long Earth.
Yeah, his new, but the hardbacks.
Yeah. But I haven't read the older non-Discworld. So this is a fun journey for us. Oh, well, Bromeliad I read when I was a kid.
Yeah, little mini journey on top of our
large journey.
Journey with a small
Jernets. No, okay, that one doesn't work. No. Go back to Oracle. Do you have an obscure reference for Neil?
Yeah, I mean, it was fucking full of them, wasn't it? But I picked one in particular because I liked the rhyme. when he's rebuilding his consciousness or being chivied along into that, he recites the Green Paternoster, which, as a good Catholic, you will know, of course, that Paternoster means Lord's Prayer.
Absolutely.
As a not very good Catholic, you might know that the Black Paternoster, you familiar with?
No,
it's it could refer to a bunch of stuff, but it's like bedtime rhymes, prayers kind of thing that are Catholic because Protestants are all uptight about that shit. Like the one you'll definitely know is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, bless the bed that I lie on.
Yeah.
But the one in the book is definitely a reference to a old obscure one. So the one in the book goes, here we go. Green Paternoster, Sadim was my foster. He saved me under the poison tree. He was made of flesh and blood to send me my right food, mine right food and heir too, that I might be a foe and stop at two, to read in that sweet book which the great gods shoop. Open, open, save me, dead, dead, shall see. Halve the population roster and say the green prayer, Paternoster. So the idea of a green Paternoster was condemned by the Bishop of Lincoln back in the 1100s. But this one, I'm pretty sure, is a slight alteration on the white Paternoster, which is from like the 1600s, I think. Mm-hmm. I have so many of these, like written in various places here. Here it is. God was my foster. He fostered me under the book of palm tree. St. Michael was my dame. He was born at Bethlehem. He was made of flesh and blood. God send me my right food. My right food and dine too, that I may to yon kirk go to read upon yon sweet book, which the mighty God of heaven's shoop. So shoop was correct. Open, open, heaven's yates. Stake, stake, hell's yates. All the saints be better that hear the white prayer, Paternoster. Shoop, by the way, seems to be the past tense of shape, so it's shaped shoop, which I would petition to bring back.
Yeah, I'm going to bring that back.
Yeah, so this is the kind of stuff that Pratchett enjoys anyway, reading stuff that's just slightly oddly spelled in an archaic way, because as we shall see in Discworld.
Yes, many archaic words.
Open, open, heaven's yates, I like.
Mm.
But yeah, that's my obscure reference for Neil, which I actually have this week, unlike last time.
I enjoyed that.
Good. I'll say, I'll put it in the show notes, the link to all of them. It's your the kind of nonsense. Yeah.
It is absolutely my sort of nonsense.
Is it right? Paternoster?
I think it's Paternoster.
Paternoster.
Pater like father.
Pater, yeah. Paternoster. Anyway, I've had random versions of them in my head all morning, so that's nice.
Excellent. Now, I'm glad that's haunting you. I've got the stupid Tumblr post you sent me the other day stuck in my head.
Sorry.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Yeah, well, spread that joy.
My apologies, listeners. So I think that's everything we've got to say about the first half. A bit of admin before we outro.
Oh.
We did mention in December that we were going to split this book into two parts rather than three. So next week we will be going from chapter 7 to the end. Mm-hmm. Francine will have also read chapter 6, hopefully.
Might just skip that one.
Yeah, it's fine. we were originally going to be talking about the Watch series this month, but it didn't occur to us that it wasn't coming out in the UK when it comes out in America and Australia. So we won't be talking about that until it comes out in the UK, because we'd both rather watch it legally. So that will be...
It's not a morality thing. I just can't be bothered to work out torrenting.
Yeah, it's morality for me. It's laziness for you. Either way. We'll be putting it off until March or so. We're not sure when it's coming out yet. Which means if you do have thoughts on it, please don't tell us yet, because we are going to try and go into it very open-minded, aren't we, Francine?
Yeah, sure, if you say so.
Maybe.
I'm being a bit less good. I'm being a bit worse than you at reading things like reviews, but I quite often disagree with reviews of things, so I don't really mind.
Yes, I'm avoiding any reviews and what have yous until we get there.
So
we'll be back next week with the second half of Dark Side of the Sun. We will possibly also bring you some kind of bonus nonsense before the end of the month.
Yeah, because there's only two episodes in this book, so on week three you'll probably hear from us with
nonsense.
Relevant.
Yeah, nothing even slightly relevant, but a fun time will be had by all. Yes. And then we'll be back on the disc in February with Small Gods.
One of the big ones.
Ironically.
Yeah.
Small Gods, big book.
Actually, one of the early hardbacks I have, thanks to you.
Oh, yeah. In the meantime, though, of course, thank you for listening to The Tree Shall Make You Fret. Please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and subscribe to us and tell other people about us. Because
it's very odd emphasis on words here, Joanna. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Two Shall Make You Fret. Please rate or review and subscribe.
You're doing a bit Matt Berry.
Sometimes the spirit of Matt Berry just overtakes me. I've accepted it. We're going with it. In the meantime, until next week, you can follow us on Instagram at The True Shall Make You Fret, on Twitter at Make You Fret Pod, on Facebook at The True Shall Make You Fret. You can join our subreddit, r/TTSMYF. You can email us your thoughts, queries, castle snacks, and albatrossipods.
The True Shall Make You Fret.
And obelisks. The True Shall Make You Fret Pod @gmail.com. And in the meantime, dear listener, don't let us detain you.
I've written down something I didn't mention because it didn't matter, but everything is damp. God, it was unpleasant reading half of that.
It is a very wet book.
I was really cold when I was reading it. It was like, oh man, this would be much nicer to read in the summer. Jesus, what a humid planet.
Yeah, I did have to be in a very nest of blankets while reading.
A very nest of blankets.
I can't speak today. The fact that we got through that episode at all is a fucking miracle.